So, cultural inclusion is described as a remarkable and compelling story of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people with disabilities, presented in a unique way that combines traditional research methods and the concept of yarning. Please enjoy and welcome Scott.
Gujiyigu. Which is welcome in my native language of Gutang. My name is Scott Avery. I'm an Aboriginal person. The Aboriginal nation where I'm from is the Warramai nation. So we think in rivers a lot. So if people know the Manning River around Taree, that's where my mob's from in New South Wales. So if you're driving from Sydney to Brisbane, it's a couple hours north. So that's where my ancestral homeland is. I'm also profoundly deaf, so I tell people this because often when I go to some of the remote communities, I wear cochlear implants and a hearing aid here, so I've got to point them out, and I go, these are cochlear implants, and I do that because sometimes they're a bit standoffish, and they're going, oh, what's that? Because in many cases, people won't have seen something, it hasn't penetrated this kind of health technology in the remote communities. And I said, I tell them that, and they go, oh, thank God for that, you're deaf. I thought you're a copper. So I often get that, like I said, oh, is this your mobile phone device, is it? And I said, no, it's actually Bionic Man. So the organisation that I'm with, I'll just talk about the organisation I'm with for a moment. So it's called the First Peoples Disability Network. So we're a non-government organisation. So we're not affiliated with any government agency. We're not affiliated with any university. We are an organisation that is owned, controlled, run by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people with disability. So everyone on our board has some experience or exposure to either living with disability themselves or a direct connection to a family member. So we're very strong on that lived experience. Like I said, I'm an Aboriginal person, I'm deaf myself, and we carry a lot of our, you know, what's happening in our life, you know, into the work that we do. We're quite a small organisation. There's about seven of us. We'd like to say we're national, but we do cover a lot of issues. You know, I say a lot of our work is inch thick, miles wide. If you're an Aboriginal person, and you're a person with disability, you know, the buzzword at the moment is intersectionality, but it does explain that if you're an Aboriginal person and you're a person with disability, sort of the social inequality and the disadvantage that you experience, and sometimes it's really hard to put that into words until you see it, but we've done our best to write that up, and as Melissa mentioned, here's a book that we produced on it. So I'm a researcher, so what I've done is, when I was starting this a number of years ago, I'm sitting in a policy role in a non-government organisation, I'm seeing all that's being written about Aboriginal people with disability, and it just did not gel with what people are telling me on the phone when they come into our office. So I was having a look at who was writing it and what was being written about it. And a lot of it was being written about it through the perspective of a service provider, often who weren't Aboriginal, and often that sat within that sort of medical model. So what they were talking about, it wasn't wrong, but it fell so far short of explaining what was really going on with our, in our communities. So we thought, you know, we'll just take this and run with it. So that's what I'm going to be talking about today. See, it's about how we've used our research, not just to find out what's going on and being able to explain what's going on, but we wanted to do it to change the narrative. And one of the narratives we want to change it through is to get the focus back on inclusion. So I don't know if you can see this, it's a bit light, but what it is, I've got here, it's a bit of artwork that we've created. And what it is, if you want to understand disability and inclusion in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities, you've actually got to cast your mind back about 25,000 years. So out in Western New South Wales, there's this an archaeological site, and it's said to be one of the largest archaeological site with footprints in the mud. And within those set of footprints, there's a single right line footprint. So it goes right footprint, right footprint, right footprint. And there's no corresponding left footprint. And of course, the Western kind of scientists are going, well, that's really, really odd. What's happened here? And then someone thought to ask the Aboriginal elders, who were the custodians of that land, and they said, well, that's a one-legged man on a hunt. And he's hunting with the clan. And they measured it, and he said, here's someone who's moving in pace. And I thought, we in our communities, we say that there's no word for disability in our language, and that's in many of the cases. It's kind of like a different belief system that we have. So we talk about this story as being symbolic of this concept of inclusion. So here's a one-legged man just participating. He's on a hunt. He's doing what everyone else does. But unfortunately, what happened is that got disrupted about 250 years ago. So 250 years ago, when this country, you know, white fellas come to this country, and we talk a lot about colonisation. And many Aboriginal scholars will do a better job than I talking about what happened in terms of land dispossession and some of the massacres that take place. But one of the things that I want to sort of draw your attention to is not only that, is there was a concept that got imported at the same time. And that concept was disability. So up until that, you know, people had sort of in our communities, and it also happened in sort of before the Industrial Revolution, is this notion of people had responsibility. They might be called cripple, or they use that language like that, but they had responsibility. They had roles in society. But with the Industrial Revolution, what happens? People essentially got commodified. They were like raw materials in a production process. So if you didn't fit the standard process, you were discarded. And that's the actual origin of the word disability. And that's the concept. That was a concept that got imported to Australia at the same time. So if you're an Aboriginal, what we say in here is saying, if you're an Aboriginal person and you're a person with disability, you kind of dispossess from your land and you dispossess from your body. And what I look at, how this sort of social history of Australia, you just don't see this story of this happening. So we thought it's this sort of missing chapter in Australia's social history that we wanted to piece together. How do we do it? Okay, so I'm a policy guy, so I spend a lot of my time in Canberra. I'm escaped this morning's Close the Gap to come and speak with you today. We have our priorities, so. But a lot of the work that I do is saying, well, when I was in a community organisation, I could see these, I could hear these stories of very personal stories. So we kind of knew this inequality was happening. We could see it, we could hear it. We just kind of couldn't prove it in a way that people would acknowledge and accept it. So what we did, we thought, and again, this is about, what I'm really talking about here is power and how power is used and where people sit in the power hierarchy. So we're going, how do we actually alter and invert some of these power structures that are actually placing people, our mobs, at the bottom of society and othering them? So we thought we needed to have an overall program. First thing is it needed to be our voices. We wanted to privilege, we wanted to promote and elevate our voices because we were not seeing that in public discourse, in policy, anywhere. It was like we did not exist. We also knew, so what we did is we wanted to go and talk to people. And our research question was, one, what is your story? Tell us your story. We want to hear your story. That was it. We encouraged people to tell their story, and then we would work out what happened from there. So that was it. And we call that testimony. And we do that, we talk about that, because the notion of testimony, when you say story, you kind of think, oh, it might be, you know, it's someone's story, it's one person's, or it might be. The notion of testimony goes to this is a truth-telling exercise. It's a truth. And it's a truth that hasn't been revealed yet. So if you give testimony in a court, it's evidence. That's how we treated it, and we gave the people telling that story that respect. The statistical data, we said, well, okay, we knew we were very pragmatic, and we said what we needed to do is we needed to get statistical data. we could see all this social inequality. I said, but there, that's a community. We just kind of want to go, well, how big is this problem? And even as something as simple as how many Aboriginal people with disability live in Australia, something as fundamental as that, which you would imagine would drive a lot of, you know, how many service providers you did. No one had actually done that work. No government agency had done it. You won't get it, you can go to the NDIA, they will not tell you. This was work that we knew that we had to drive. And the third piece that we did was what we called yarning pieces. Because when you start putting data, whether it's testimonial data or it's numbers, and you start putting them into themes, one of the things that you risk doing is losing the character of the story, the humanity of the story. So we wanted to keep that humanity and how all of these issues come together in the life of one person. So just to do that, that's the kind of what we're talking about. And we put it as a research program so we could publish, we could teach people. That's the legacy that we wanted to do. We wanted people to hear this story. And thank you to Melissa for actually inviting me here today to share it. Again, I talked about the power structures. So we wanted to invert them. Now, as a researcher, I have a lot to do with many, many universities. Could be 20, 30 of them that I can think of. And what they would normally do is they'll come to me and say, here's a research project that I want to do, but I need your advice. Will you be on my advisory committee? We will hold the money. We will tell you. You can give us advice. We'll decide whether we use it or not, but we'd really like you to be part of that. Or a lot of governments do this. So government agencies tend to do this. They go, we're going to have an investigation or an inquiry, and we would like you to give testimony and an evidence to us. But if you're going to make us uncomfortable, we might just, you know, talk about things like inequality, we might just put that out there on that thing. So again, the power was within the person who's commissioning it. So if we wanted to empower our community and the people who were in it, we had to invert those power structures. So what we did is our community is leading this program. We said, you know what, we'll just do it ourselves. So my organisation, the First Peoples Disability Network, we say we're the research host. We're the host. Now, we do have relationships with other people, so we've got a fantastic number of academic and research supporters. But their relationship is different. Their relationship is to us what it used to be to them, is they're our advisors, and we kind of, it's our values, our belief, it's our understanding of inclusion that we want. So that's what's driving the show. So if they give us advice, we can then go, you know what, thank you for that, that's wonderful, this is where it's incompatible. We will make the decision in favour of our values and systems. So that's what we did. We also had technical advisors, and I think this is where I want to just give a big rap to the Australian Bureau of Statistics, which is, I think, is the unusual suspect in our story, because a lot of this, because the data, and people say, there's not a lot of data on this. It's actually a different message I want to send to you. There is data there, but it's often not configured and structured away to support your cause. So there's an art you have to do in reconfiguring it in a way that would actually support your argument. So we did that with the Australian Bureau of Statistics, which is very unusual for us, for a very small not-for-profit Aboriginal organisation, to engage with them. But they've been a fantastic supporter in getting data that was there but buried and hidden in databases and putting it in our hands that we could do it for an agenda that we wanted to pursue. So that's our model. I'm the person sitting in the middle. It upsets the universities a bit, but I tell them that, look, I answer to FPDN, not the university. So, but that's just how it's worked. I spoke a bit about intersectionality. Again, I want to sort of reinforce, intersectionality is not, I happen to be Aboriginal and I happen to have a disability. It's not that kind of thing. Intersectionality, it explains power relationships. It helps you understand power relationships within society. So what it is just like a power hierarchy. So you might not be Aboriginal, you might not be, but what happens if you're Aboriginal and you're a person with disability, if you're either of those, you're disempowered relative to a dominant power structure, if you like. If you then combine the two, or you intersect the two, the relative power that you have, and there's a lot of theoretical work, if you're really interested in intersectionality, go to the source. The person you need to read is a person by the name of Kimberly Crenshaw. Read her work, and it's really helps you understand this in terms of power. Because we're saying, if you understand power, you're really understanding this. The word empowerment is used as a cliche. Understand what you're really trying to do is disrupt power structures. So intersectionality, it happens across the life trajectory of an Aboriginal person with disability. So this is what I call a life trajectory. It starts at a very young age. So if you're an Aboriginal person, you might be born into an environment where there is, a lot of public infrastructure and utilities that we have in metropolitan areas, we kind of take for granted that there are people in Australia that don't have running water, clean access to clean water, they live in overcrowded housing, they live where there's footpaths. That's what we're talking about. Now, if you're a child born in that, there's a correlation between the likelihood, if you have a mismanaged disability, there's an unavoidable impact that you could actually have if you're in that environment. So things like low birth weight and all those kind of things are related to living in that area. So then what happens is you then couple it with, if you're an Aboriginal child, and we know that Aboriginal children are 10 times more likely than other children to be removed from their family and community. So that, we know that. It's 14 times if you've got a disability as well. If you do that, and then what happens is you get placed in an out-of-home care system. So we talk to carers and foster parents and that, and they say, our foster child can't get a lot of the tests because the service providers tell us that if you're in an unstable family environment, you know, you get false readings and all that. So if you're an Aboriginal child, you have an undiagnosed disability, you are now through to your schooling years and you've fallen through the cracks. Then we get to the schooling with the thing we call the bad black kid syndrome. And this is where presentations of someone's disability is misconstrued as delinquent behaviour. So they go, well, it's not a case of you might struggle to hear or you might have a cognitive impairment. You're cast as a bad black kid. It's almost this punitive model of education starts. And then that carries forward, which means it struggled to get a job. I call this a matriculation pathway into prison because so many the profile of juvenile detention, it's Aboriginal people with cognitive and hearing and trauma. That's a profile. Now, this might be very confronting to people, but again, if you understand it's not inherent in the person, you can see this trajectory and you can kind of go, there are pivot points where we can alter that trajectory. And that's where we kind of get to. That's where we're kind of going to get our sort of advocacy efforts when we talk about systemic advocacy. We've got to move it from needing to prove this into actually how can we alter the trajectory. So the pattern, I said the statistical data is a pattern. And I've just got a chart here, and this is a pattern about this relates to access healthcare. The question was, do you have a problem accessing healthcare services? So the general population's on the far left, that's a very low bar. And what happens is this, you move across. So if you're a person with disability, and column three is if you're an Aboriginal person without a disability, so their car, it goes up. The inequality that you face goes up. This is all real data. You add the two together, so you're an Aboriginal person with some disability that's not severe and profound, it goes up again. The inequality that you face goes up. If you add severity of disability again, so if you're an Aboriginal person with disability that is severe and profound, the inequality or the barriers you face go up. So you're really talking about understanding this concept of, now we can start getting, and this is what the data is showing, and it's not just the Aboriginal population that this concept's applied to. You may be involved with young children that experience trauma. Kind of this notion of there are vulnerable population groups that you will deal with, I said, you just can't apply a one size fits all. Get to know the backstory, because the data's saying that they all have barriers that if you pitch it at the midpoint, they won't get access to some of the things that you're trying to do. I'm just going to talk a bit about a discussion we had earlier with Marianne, I think it was. We're talking about the interface of structure versus personal agency. Now, a bit of a techo term, but the National Disability Insurance Scheme, it's all about personal independence. So I give you something, you get personal choice. Very focused on that. Kind of doesn't happen outside with, well, in what environment are you placing that? So I've got a few examples here to draw out. So you actually need to understand the environment where you're putting in personalised care to make it effective. So I travel a lot to remote communities and remote Aboriginal communities. I'm talking about if you drive from Alice Springs to sort of Tennant Creek, there's this loop. You go down this road, it's an 80 kilometre road and you know, you're 80 kilometres down the road, the settlement sort of pops up. That's the kind of place we're talking about here. So this community where I took the photo and with the permission of the community, I should point, is this house was built under remote access housing scheme. So someone's gone in and sort of said, oh, there's no housing in remote communities, we better build it. But there's no consultation with the family and no consultation or consideration about disability. So I'm just going to walk over here for a bit. So see that bit there? That's a ledge. It's about that high. So I said, well, what happens when the mob with disability come over? So we have to lift them over. Now, we have to even lift them over that ledge. So here's something built with one intention. Yep, we've got a structural issue. Didn't have the personal thinking, and that's a problem. So I'm going to have a reverse scenario now. This is a wheelchair that we saw just down the road a bit, actually. So this wheelchair that you would have, it's in a metropolitan area, it's very light, fold up, you can chuck it in the back of your boot, off you go. You take that same wheelchair and you put it into a remote environment. So the combination of the extreme heat and the lack of footpaths, you see, if you have a look there, the rubber wheels had melted off. So that had been discarded. And I said, again, we're kind of going, ugh, where's this fit for purpose? So this is something that we're going, is you really need to think about the environment that you're placing it, that you're support into. And even I'll get onto this when I talk about mental health in a few moments. One of the things that I did see, and I thought this is, we hear a lot about, oh, we've got to build trust with people, we've got to do, you know, we want to engage and all this kind of thing. But this is something that I saw in my research as well. It was like this pathway. And it started with people would go, look, I kind of expect I'm going to be discriminated against, or I fear it. It's intuitive to me. Particularly if I'm Aboriginal, I might cop racism, and as a person with disability, I might get ableism. And sometimes they come together. And that was something that people were voluntarily talking about. And it started off with that. But then what happened is it's this intuitive fear. People sort of said, oh, hang on, this is starting to happen to me. So I moved from this intuitive fear to actually, you know what, this is a rational understanding of I'm going to be discriminated against. So what happens is then they go, well, you know what, and this is a very rational response to that, I'm going to disengage. I'm going to avoid participating in scenarios where, in situations where I might be discriminated. It's kind of to protect myself. So I've called that apprehended discrimination, because there's this notion of apprehension, which is basically said, I'm getting more exposure to this. My fear, which started out, has become real. And I'll give, there's a few examples, but I think I'll just focus on one to give some time. So one case that I saw was in the employment area. So you can almost do your own social experiment here and have a look at the visibility of people in employment. Go to Westfield, you see all these shops, and it just doesn't have the visibility of people with disability. So there was one young Torres Strait Islander girl that I spoke with, and she spoke about her experiences. She's Torres Strait Islander background. She has cerebral palsy. She's doing 2 degrees at a Queensland university. And when I spoke with her, she was going, yeah, but I can't get a job like my friends can get a job at like the Westfield kind of jobs. I think she mentioned Katie's and Suzanne. And she said, I would write to them. She's beautifully spoken on the phone, writes well. She said, yeah, come in. She said, the moment she comes in, it's you don't fit the brand. That's the language and the words that they use. So this notion of you don't have value to us. I think these guys need a major rebrand if that's the case. But that's what I heard. I heard that story consistently. I heard it from an Aboriginal deaf man. He said, my dream job is I just want to be a steward on an airline. And he actually paid people to help him with an application. And he applied for the airlines. They said, oh, sorry, we don't hire deaf people. That was it. So his life dream just got shattered like that. So it's the arrogance I found really personally confronting here. The arrogant kind of dismissal of it that really gets under you. So then I was presenting in a forum like this to an Aboriginal community organisation with a vision impaired, and someone come up to me afterwards and said, "Oh, so you know those jobs that says you know you're a stakeholder management or customer service person and that." A lot of them must have driver's license, even though it's completely unrelated to that job. I said, I can get myself there. Why does it have this as a standard requirement? And he goes, I don't even bother applying to that now because I know they can use that to discriminate against me. So this is this notion of, I said, you can have the best systems in the world and that, but unless you understand the backstory, if you want to building trust with people, this is the kind of thing we actually need to flip it around from apprehended discrimination, I expect to be discriminated against, into flipping it into I expect to be included. I'll quickly talk about this for people who are doing work within Aboriginal communities, particularly if you're not directly or haven't had a lot of experience. It's just the understanding of if you're talking about children and the connection to child removal policies. I said, really know that staff and how that can be a lightning rod or trigger point for so much trauma in people. We're not surprised, but we are surprised how unsurprised people come into our communities and don't understand how traumatic it might be to have a child taken away from you. So if you're in that space, the notion of to be trauma-informed is to think it through. So I'll put that there, but I'll just flag it. Again, the data that we had, so 60,000 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people with disability. The rule of thumb is if you are an Aboriginal person and you have disability, the inequality in every single indicator that we looked at, every single indicator with one exception I'll get to, is twice that of other Aboriginal people. So that's other Aboriginal people. So something like education, which is a story that the Prime Minister spoke of today in the Close the Gap, he focused on education. That's the rule of thumb. Aboriginal disability, twice that of other Aboriginal people. So if you only do culturally inclusive education and don't get the disability part, the best case scenario is you're probably getting it halfway. That's the significance of this. And this, what we're talking about, when you've exposed to discrimination and you're exposed to inequality, the impact that has on your mental health. I hope you can come through me on this journey because it does change tack in a few moments. And I know it can be very confronting for people. So this is the education. So the Prime Minister spoke about education today for Aboriginal children. Proposal is that we waive HECS for new graduates, I guess, and have them teach in remote communities. This is saying that there's another story to it and there's disability. So that's the indicators of children. And it's so vital because you're carrying it through. Where this sits in the life trajectory is so vital. I'll move through this. Change of tack now. And this was a discussion that I had with an Aboriginal man in a remote community. And the first part of the discussion was, he was telling a lot about the health service that he was experiencing in some of these places. And about 20 minutes in, he lifted up his trouser leg like this and goes, I've had an operation. And he showed me. And I could see this pin sticking out of his knee. It was about that long. It was about that. It looked one of those mountains. I always think it's one of those mountains if you go in the outback that pop up. And I'm kind of going, okay. And I'm going, well, how long ago was this? And what was the story? And he progressively revealed during it that he'd had the knee operation. He'd gone to Alice Springs, which I figured out was about a 6 or 7 hour ride on his own. I said, well, who came back with you? I said, well, I'm on my own. And I said, oh, where are you staying now? And he goes, oh, I'm sleeping rough, which is basically homelessness. I'm kind of going, he's an elderly Aboriginal man. He's just been charged from an Australian healthcare system into homelessness after a major knee operation. And I'm just kind of going, okay, why don't we know this stuff? And he was telling me about he has to travel about, he has to pick up a bucket of water to get fresh water from a camping ground about, he's got to go 500 metres with a bucket of water. I said, are you okay doing that? Like, you know, so these are the things that we have. But there was a turning point then. And this is where we can actually move from thinking about the inequality to thinking about inclusion. Because then what he started to tell me about, I said, well, what happens if you get in trouble, mate? And he goes, well, we all look out for each other in our community. Some of us have got mobile phones and we all stick together. I said, yeah, there's lots of people with disability in these town camps, but we all stick together and we look out for each other. And then he started going, well, and I sort of said, well, what's your future like? And he goes, look, I don't have a house and my challenge is I've got to keep my food. I've got to keep it off the ground. The dogs don't get it and down below so the birds don't get it. So that's what I've got to do. So I want a house. I want dignity, I want respect. And he said, house. He said, I want a home, I want to go home. And I thought, that's not too much for a nation like us to provide. But that notion of we were community. So then that tweaked, it moved from this story of inequality into, despite all this inequality, we're surviving this. And there was one Aboriginal elder lady that I met with, and again, she was in a motorised wheelchair when I met her, and she's an amputee. A lot of these places you go to, just the diabetes and that, there's a lot of amputees there. And hysterical story, she sat next to her husband and she goes, oh, we go hunting together. And I thought, wow, well, how she spoke about that. We go hunting together, kind of move from beyond the physical task to I have a spiritual connection to something. And I thought, wow. And she would say, oh, look, I sit in the car and I tell my husband what to do because he's pretty hopeless and he doesn't know what to look for, so I have to yell out the window. But we go hunting together. And so I started hearing more of that. And I went, okay, despite this inequality, despite this disadvantage, despite what we would in Western world call disability, there's this culture of inclusion that's sitting there. So we started listening to those narratives, that story, and I thought, we now have a line of sight between the one-legged Mongo man and what we're hearing today. And I'm thinking, okay, so how we provide services, a national disability insurance scheme, what's the goal of that? We have to make ourselves disabled in order to get services, in order to access services. We have to disable ourselves. And I'm kind of going, let's flip that round. As we've inverted everything else around, let's get the focus back onto inclusion. Let's talk about inclusion. And let's start with that. So that's the belief system upon which we can now build our disability services when we go into our classroom. That's our belief system, that our children are to be included, whether they're Aboriginal, whether they're from an ethnic background, whether they're from the asylum seeker. That's the philosophy that we do. And I thought if we can change that philosophy, some of these things will start developing in a way. I've just got a few more here, but I just want to open it up for a bit of discussion as well. I said a lot of these that I've talked about and I can gauge from people, it can be just to sort of quieten the room how confronting this might be to people who are very socially conscious and may not have had an opportunity that. So I'm very, very mindful of that. But this is kind of your permission slip, if you like. This thing here is your permission slip to go, you know what? When you see discrimination, when you see ableism, if you see racism, if you see people who should be getting a fair go but not getting a fair, this is your permission slip to say, actually, no, thank you, not on my watch, because it actually requires this very grounded movement that happens at people who are providing services to people or supporting people. This is where this kind of thing needs to change. We need to lead it here in this room. And as confronting as hard might to hear this message, I want to share a story of hope. Again, it does start with quite a traumatic story, but it does shift. And it's the pathway that we have to shift, that we have to heal people through. So the story that I met a young Aboriginal man. He lived in a housing complex, so probably the size of this, and maybe 30-ish people living in kind of a complex, a very, very confined situations. And one of the young men, he said, look, I go to the psychologist once a week, as I'm supposed to. He kind of referenced to an employment plan or support plan. He said, I'm supposed to do that, so I go. And I sit in the room. He said, but the moment I leave, people wind down the window and yell out a racial name at me. So all that thing's been undone straight away. So it's kind of like the mental health version of that busted wheelchair. If you put clinical psychology in a hostile environment like that, you've got your melted wheels. So it's that kind of metaphor. But I was speaking to him, and the community had a lot of trauma, like just really affected. You know, it's almost like contagious because it was such a small space. But he towards the end, he goes, you know what? There is something stronger here. And he pointed to his heart and he said, I've just got to get there. And I think so, as difficult as it is to get your head around this, it's the acceptance of some of these things are happening in our country. But how do we get a philosophy of care that actually makes that person get to where he wants to get to? So I always close off to say, look, for whatever reason you came here today, every one of you have actually followed a single right footstep to hear this. So thank you again. I hope that you take this presentation and go away and sort of think, okay, what does this actually mean for me? And what can I do to be much more inclusive, carry this philosophy inclusive, and walk the floor for inclusion. So I'm going to hand it over now to the microphone. And if people want to ask questions or provide their personal reaction to what they've heard. But thank you.
Hi, Greg Croft is my name. Just to support Scott's comments, for those who don't know the trauma of a child being removed from a community, the procedure is territory families fly in unannounced, hire a car, drive to the house, pick up the child and leave, and the whole thing takes no more than 15 minutes. There is no warning, the police not involved, no community members are involved. So a lot of people have to endure this. I've seen it firsthand too many times, unfortunately, so it's something we don't see. But on the other side, I have been to places like Omnipalli, and I've seen people in wheelchairs and in hot weather, which is quite rampant up there. The families take them out, put them in creeks so they're cooling down, so the wheelchairs get new bearings on a regular basis. So it's quite good. So thank you for your comments.
Any other questions or comments?
Firstly, I'd like to add, oh, is that right? Okay, sorry. Firstly, I just want to say thank you. I just wondered, I don't know whether you touched on this and I missed it, but I just wondered whether there was a word for disability in terms of in the Indigenous language. Okay, yep. And then I also just wondered what the white invasion of what the perceptions of disability was in Indigenous culture.
Yeah, so the first question was, is there a word for disability in Aboriginal languages? And the answer is no. It's not this overarching concept of disability. So there are some Aboriginal languages that contain word around impairment. So there is a paper, and it's actually referenced in my book. The person's name is Ariotti, if you want to look him up and you're interested in that. But that was a seminal piece. We actually went into the APY lands, and it actually looked about how people spoke about people with physical diversity, you know, that kind of stuff. And they didn't talk about it in a pejorative way. Where I work, it's in Gadigal land. So people would say to me, oh, you're a bit dinbin, which roughly translates to dead ear. But it's not used in a pejorative sense to kind of saying, well, you're deaf, we need to fix you. It's just kind of a nod and a wink to kind of go, look, you just need to acknowledge the fact he's not going to talk, he's not going to hear you unless you're looking at him. It's that kind of, again, it's that belief system that is there. And it's a different belief system. And I saw it not just in Aboriginal culture, but you see it in Maori culture. I've read things about Navajo culture. The word they use is Honzo. And so there's a philosophy. It's a philosophy going, you know, we just kind of take all comers. And even that, like I said, in the Western culture that we know now, that was actually what it was like before the Industrial Revolution. It's the Industrial Revolution that kind of went, well, we're going to treat people like commodities, and they started, you know, basically labelling people. If you couldn't participate in the production process, you are not abled. That's the origin of that word. And so it's very, actually, the concept of disability, as it is known, is quite a new concept in many ways. And what happens is then the orthopaedic movement came along and said, well, those that were discarded, we can now fix some of you. So it went from a medical model, which is about, you know, you're broken, we can fix you, to a social model that says, you know, the environment's broken, we can accommodate you. The cultural model of inclusion has said, mate, just come sit with us. It's just a philosophy of difference that, and I said, that's the culture. It's not about the linguistics. That's why, you know, they talk about words for snow and that. You know, it's what you see. We don't see it. That's why there's no words. And it's very difficult. It's very difficult for us then, because we know that this world we're in now requires us to negotiate on those terms. This is what I'm saying about the NDIS forces us to disable ourselves, because it's actually against our culture and our belief system. So I hope I got you there in the end.
Any other questions?
Hi, my question follows on from that directly. What do you actually do to help people walk that balance between inclusion and having to disable themselves so they can access what they are entitled to?
So the question was, what do you actually do to support the people? Well, I suppose we're in a dilemma at the moment. It's kind of like we've got the worst of both worlds in that we're struggling to get the access to the supports, but we've got the labels as well, the stigmatising labels. And I think the path that at least I've chosen to do with this research is to bust through some of those labels. So it's how we talk about people and just being alert to particularly the degree of ableism that is actually, that's what people were saying. It chipped away at them. It just chip. So the nature of racism and ableism, people spoke about them separately but also together as well. So racism, people saying, I would be like kind of attacked, real nastiness to us. So people would call me a really nasty, they could feel the anger. With the disability, it's like you're not in the room. So people were telling me, they said, one of the person I remember now, he said, look, I go to coffee shops and the waiter or restaurants, the waiter would talk to the people around me. What would this person want? So that they're constantly dehumanised. And you see it even in language. I know the federal election's come up. I'm getting really worried because I'm deaf, and the amount of politicians who people don't agree with, beyond, are you deaf or something? And I said, it is just this culture of dehumanising, and it just chips away at you. Sometimes it really gets you. That's what was coming through. So what we wanted, this is what we want to talk about, is changing the philosophy to inclusion and supporting that healing process, but acknowledging that happens is the first part of it. So a lot of this was talking about, a lot of people carry what I would call subconscious bias. So again, that doctor who discharged that Aboriginal man into homelessness, I can imagine the scenario, there might be three or four people, oh, we need a bed, or hang on, or no one's going to find out about that person, so we can discharge them. It's that bias. And I said, they've probably could justify it under a clinical decision. I said, yeah, but that's not equity, that's not care. And by raising these, it's saying, actually, we do know. And in the book, I say, subconscious bias, the first thing you need to do is raise it to conscious, because you've got to remove that defense of unconscious bias. So that's how I present this and talk. And I think that's going to set us on a better frame for answering some of those questions about, well, what's the right kind of service? We start from the right assumption. And so that's a lot of how we've approached this. That's why we're doing what we do in the way we do, because we think if we can think inclusion and talk inclusion and create that environment collusion for inclusion, then everything will follow from that.
I have a quick question for you, Scott. You know how there's a lot of work happening? There's a lot of work happening around with the, like, the treaty and closing the gap and all those reports around on the government level. How do you think that will work towards creating more of an inclusive culture?
So if I got it right, the question was around close the gap and how you're doing that and inclusive culture. I think this is some of the battle that we're having. And in Australia, it can be one thing. You can be Aboriginal or a person with disability. You know, this is how we've set our policy framework up. So we have the National Disability Insurance Scheme. And we're kind of going, well, how does this fit within Aboriginal communities? It goes, oh, no, we've got the scheme, you know, build it, well, they'll come. So we have that on that front. And the constant battle we're having with Close the Gap, it's, well, the issues for Aboriginal communities are that great. It's like we're in, and when we talk about this for 25 years within our community, it's like you're on the lowest rung of the service ladder. So it's like, oh, once we fix housing, once we fix education, once we fix employment, once for that, we'll eventually get to disability. And the battle we kind of have, I said, you've got to come and learn to walk and chew gum at the same time. That's the nature of intersectionality. It kind of goes, well, we'll solve this for the most people and then we'll get to you. Problem with that is you're kind of creating, because you never actually do get to the most vulnerable people within the marginalised communities, you never get there. You haven't in the last 25 years since we started talking about that. What you're essentially doing is creating almost like an underclass. You're sleepwalking into this underclass where you never get to the most vulnerable people. Now, our argument is flip it round. If we can solve problems for our most vulnerable, then you solve it for others as well. If you can get inclusive, if you can get an education program that is both inclusive of culture and of disability, well, you get both the other ways as well. It's hard, it's complex. I don't discount that. But again, we got to that book and where we are by one research question. What is your story? That is as complex as we needed to make it. And I think this is, we can often make our systems so complex and impenetrable going, get back to what the fundamental purpose is, and we're actually providing these systems to support people who need it. So get back to that. Break down some of this unnecessary complexity. We haven't, I've got to warn you, we haven't won that battle. And we, that's why I'm here and not in Canberra today for Close the Gap, because I thought, well, you know, we're just not on the radar. But we need people to say, kind of get it on the radar, please. So.
Hello, my name is Simon, and I work for, can you hear through the microphone?
I have to lip read, so would you mind?
Yep, sorry, I'll look at you, Scott. So it's fine if you look at the interpreter, that's okay, I don't mind. I'm used to doing this in using an interpreter. So I work for Deaf Victoria as an advocacy officer and for hard of hearing people in Victoria. One issue that I have noticed is Aboriginal people being included in the conversation. I've worked for the service for about a year and maybe more. What I've noticed and what I'm extremely aware of is that I'm not Aboriginal myself. I don't have a lot of knowledge and expertise of their communities. I understand there may be deaf people within those communities, but if they see me as a white person representing Deaf Victoria, they might not feel encouraged to engage with our organisation. And I accept all of this, but at the same time, for all of Victorians, we provide a service, whether they're from any cultural background. So this is where we stand at the moment. And I don't know about other advocacy services in this room. Maybe it would be of a similar philosophy. But my question is, I'd like to say, what I'm wondering is, how can we be allies with the First Peoples communities? How can we develop that engagement so that we can have an allegiance with them without interrupting their cultural norms, without being invasive, without being excluding them? It's not saying that we're not going to provide service. We would like to provide service, engage and partner with them. But how do we make that happen?
Thank you for the question. Apologies for having to look there to lip read. So it's quite fascinating you actually brought up that particular issue, because within the cohort, I spoke to 47 Aboriginal people as part of my research. And the first group, the very first group that said, can we please be involved, and they're called the Deadly Deaf Mob. And they are deaf Aboriginal people. And they actually contacted me because they knew me anyway, because I'm actually don't sign, but they know me anyway, and I'm part of there. And it was a social network. I came to something like this. I said, I want to do some research. This is what it's going to look like. And they said, we want to be first. So they're very strong, and they're very strong about that. So the group is called the Deadly Deaf Mob, and I can put you in touch with these people as well. But I actually wrote about it in the book, because, again, we'll find this. So there was 11 of them, and the 11 people, and we did them all in Auslan. All the interviews were done in Auslan, so we had the video running, and we had a recorder, so we could get the text, and we transcribed that, and we did it. And I'm actually remembering once there was in South Australia, and an interpreter got sick at the very, very last moment. And so we had to do it via Skype, and we had one interpreter in Sydney, one interpreter in Brisbane next to the computer. And the reason I tell that story, it's kind of, if you value inclusion, you just make stuff happen. You know, these stiffers just kind of bumps in the road. But they tell, and some of their stories, and again, this is where it comes to culture, some of their story is a disability story. So on that regard, you can talk to those issues. Some of it is an Aboriginal story. You're not able to talk to those issues, but you can talk with people about it. Sometimes, and this is where the kind of nuance understanding, sometimes it's because I'm Aboriginal and I'm deaf, that's a problem. The two things coming together. And one of the particular issues of racism and ableism coming together is this: is when people have prejudicial stereotypes about Aboriginal people drinking. But someone who's deaf might not, the way they speak, and they go, oh, you're not deaf, you're a drunk Aboriginal. And we heard that story. So that's how these things intersect in the life. In terms of your question, I think, you know, I can put you in touch with some of those people if you'd like to get their details. They will speak with you. Again, let them tell their story first, because they will have issues. And I think this is a message that understanding what your lane is, where your lane is it a disability lane? Is it an Aboriginal lane? Our lane is that intersection. There'll be things in Aboriginal communities I don't really talk about. I don't talk about land rights. I don't want to talk about that kind of stuff. I talk about what is it like for an Aboriginal person with disability. That's my lane. And respecting that. But again, through the power of storytelling, and you can build trust, and you might need to be patient because some of these people might have had bad experiences in the past. But if you come to respect, if you come to the room with respect, as I see you would do, then you will have that relationship. That's what drives, we're very relational people. You build relations with, we don't care about fancy titles or that kind of stuff. You could be professor this or professor that, it doesn't matter. If we have a relationship with you and we get that respect, we'll spot it.
We've got time for one last question. One last question.
Mine was just, is it possible to get a copy of your slides from the presentation today? Oh, fantastic.
Everything that we see here today, like all the slides and everything, will be available on our website later. Okay.
I just want to give, if you don't mind, a final plug for our book before I sign off. So, this is our book. I said we're a non-government organisation, but we've produced this, and it's a beautiful book, and it's got a lot of the stories in there. We kind of designed it as a bit of a thinking person's coffee table book. So it is, if you can have a look at some of the images that we have in there, they're kind of high gloss. So it's designed at a particular market, but if people want to go onto our website, fpdn.org.au, they might want it. And if you work for a university, they might put it in their library, because I think there's about 8, and just kind of go, why haven't you got it? Or you might be a community library. So we're a non-government organisation. We had to produce this ourselves, so we didn't work through a publisher. We just did it ourselves. So I should point out it's $176, so that might be awkward for people, but you know, we do want it to get a you know, high-quality publication that really can provoke some of these discussions. So. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Carl. I think we all appreciated this. This is a really amazing book, and really encourage you to buy the book. And thank you for making the time to come and speak to us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.